I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today we talk with two novelists whose books couldn't be more different and have written about the challenges of difference, of motherhood, and of finding stability in a sometimes hostile world. Shanti Sekaran brings us Lucky Boy, the saga of two women, strangers and cultures apart, whose lives are connected through the life of an infant boy. Later in the broadcast, I'll talk with Shelby London Heath, whose book, The Twilight Tsunami, is a raw, funny, and real account of the lives of people involved in the child welfare system. It's a novel idea. California native Shanti Sekaran is a Berkeley writer and teaches at the California College of the Arts. Her first novel is The Prayer Room, the life story of an intercultural couple of which is said the delight is in the details, in the wry and often touching perceptions of Sekaran and her characters. Her second novel is Lucky Boy, also exploring culture and power, and ultimately, the depth of a mother's love. Here is our conversation. Shanti Sekaran, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. We're happy to have you here, too, with this book, Lucky Boy, your latest publication, which is a real confluence of stories of women's lives, of motherhood, of immigration, and of Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can tell us, Lucky Boy, what that means.
So Lucky Boy, the title, refers to Ignacio. Ignacio is a baby who is born to an undocumented young woman from Mexico. Her name is Soli. Ignacio is born in Berkeley, and he is raised by his mother for the first year of his life, and then his mother, Soli, is taken into a detention center, and he goes into the care of a foster parent and foster mother and father, Rishi and Kavya Reddy. So Kavya is his new mother, and he's lucky because he is sincerely loved and wanted by these two sets of parents, and perhaps ironically, a little unlucky because with all of this love, he is thrown to the fates somewhat. He's not cognizant of any of this, but the reader doesn't know where he's going to end up.
And these two stories, Soli, who comes up from Mexico, she's a young woman and has a lot of courage in what she's doing, yet when she gets here, and it was not an easy journey, and as the story unfolds, we find out more and more about her journey. But when she arrives in California and makes her way to Berkeley, it's amazing that we as the reader feel that sense of being circumspect and cautious, curious. And how did you construct her as a character, and how were you able to describe that journey with such vividness and sometimes brutality?
That was a product of research and imagination and really allowing myself to get inside the head of someone whose life did not resemble mine. So starting off, I was quite daunted because Soli is Mexican, she's undocumented, I'm neither of those things. And the first thing I did was to start telling her story, start building her character from a first person point of view. The book is actually now written in third person, but I started sort of by plunging into her head in the first person to remove that wall of separation between me and her. And, you know, I did a lot of research into what the journeys are like for people, whether they ride the trains or whether they get across the border in other ways. And there's some great documentaries out there. I spoke with a psychologist who works with undocumented immigrants specifically. And so all of this kind of worked together. And I've been an immigrant in a sense. I lived in England for 6 years. So I know what that discomfort is like. Even though my circumstances were comfortable and documented, I know what it's like to feel just out of place and just want to feel normal again in a new home.
It's this mix of trust and caution. You have to trust somebody, but you always have to be alert and watching. And we get to experience her own kind of reactions to some of what she's experiencing. There's a, as Soli gets a job in as a housekeeper and in Berkeley, and the woman she works for, as Soli's getting more and more pregnant, the woman shows her her own birth film. And what made you throw that in like that?
You know, I don't know what made me throw that in. I guess it came to me as something that someone in Berkeley might do. The senora, as Soli calls her, Mrs. Cassidy, looks for some sense of sisterhood with this woman, which I think is an impulse that I see a lot around me in California and the Bay Area, is a search for solidarity, regardless of race, regardless of experience, which is noble in and of itself. But when Soli encounters this, you know, the senora's showing her a birth video. It's a different thing for Soli in her situation, being alone, being, you know, kind of scared. It's a different thing for her to see a birth video than it might be for another woman. And this is something that the senora doesn't quite understand, despite her good intentions.
There is a real class distinction there raised of, as you say, maybe the senora wanting to bring Soli in, but Soli not being able to travel that road. And Soli is staying with her cousin, who kind of sets her up in the business and is also part of Soli's troubles as this story progresses. And Soli gives birth to this child, and the, there are these parallel stories in the book. And so the other parallel story is with another woman who wants to be a mother, Kavya. And can you talk about
her? Yeah, so Kavya is a chef in Berkeley. She's grown up in the U.S. She's a second-generation Indian immigrant like me. And she has a beautiful life. She has a happy marriage to Rishi, but she can't get pregnant, and that's been a real struggle for her. So she decides to try to foster and hopefully foster adopt. And that's how she meets Ignacio. And, you know, a lot of foster parents that I spoke about keeping a certain amount of emotional distance from the children they're fostering because it's so hard to love a child and then give them up. If they have to give them back to their parents or back to the state for adoption. Kavya is impulsive and spunky, and she doesn't put those guards up. She falls absolutely in love with this little boy that she's fostering, and therein lies our problem.
Between these two women who both have this intense love for this lucky boy, I saw that they had almost, and I thought it was interesting, both brown-skinned people from very different backgrounds and cultures, but they both experience a kind of brutality. And I thought that Kavya's was the brutality of expectation and of medicine, and that she and her husband, the act of procreation becomes almost a chore, and that they really work hard to get a child, and that it really boils down to a lot of self-worth too, whereas Soli's brutality was inflicted by others.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I found that their stories are so different, yet they both seem to arrive at motherhood through difficult circumstances.
Yeah. For Kavya, she experiences what I think a lot of immigrants experience. This story that she's told that if you work hard enough in this country, you can do anything you want, you can be anything you want. And that makes sense for the most part, except when she tries to have a child. You know, she works and works and works at it, and it doesn't happen. She can't be a mother. She can't be what she wants to be. And that's a really hard reality for her to swallow. But it is a reality that's of a different class to Soli's. Soli's reality is much more physically brutal. It's much more about pain that's inflicted by outside institutions, by abuses of power, even.
Soli learns a lot while she is essentially taking care of somebody else's child. But this is also a situation that, we don't want to give too much of the story away, but leads Soli into being in detention for a while. And I think that was, for me reading it, was kind of a shocking read of really everything that Soli experienced that way. And I think that many of us, and I was making an assumption that you were basing this on what you know of what people experience. And I think that's something many of us don't think about, that we maybe hear about detention or deportation, but don't visualize or comprehend what that means to the individual. And maybe you could talk about your research on that or how you discovered that.
Yes. So my initial research was from a report that was written about detention centers and the lack of resources available to detainees in terms of things as simple as phones, as communications. You know, detainees, when they are put in detention centers, have very few resources at their disposal. Detention centers are very much holding places, but sometimes people are held there for years. They're not short-term situations. So there's a great website called Crimmigration, and if you look that up, that you can learn a lot about what's happening right now in detention centers. I also trained with a detention advocacy group. Their initial mission was to send volunteers to detention centers to meet regularly with the detainee who's signed up for this, and to just be a sympathetic ear for that person, just to listen to whatever that person wants to talk about once a week. They then shifted their focus to a more legal advocacy bent. So that all changed, but I did get to train with them and visit the Richmond detention facility and just learn a little more about the psychology of what it is like to be behind bars when you are not at heart truly a criminal.
and separated from your child and having no resources and having limited language skills to communicate and keepers that have no empathy.
Sure. You know, of course, there's a range in how people are treated. But when you have an imbalance of power, like you have in a prison system or in a detention system, you're going to have abuses of that power. And that happens to detainees.
Your descriptions in the book of how these two mothers relate to this young boy. And they each have a nickname for him, mm-hmm. But your descriptions of the smell and the texture of the hair and were quite evocative and warm. Do you have children yourself? It just was to me dripping with a mother's love.
Yeah, I do have two boys. One is almost 9, and the other is 3.5. So some of the writing about Ignacio, especially in his very first newborn days, came from my own writing after my first son was born. It's a very emotional time, especially the first time you have a child. You know, your world is just upended and you're brought to sort of the edge of experience. You know, I believe the ideal situation for a writer is to have some sort of heightened experience, to be at the edge of what you think you can do, the edge of what you know. And that really brings out some great writing for me. So I had some good descriptions of my little boy when he was first born. And I've held on to those for years. And some of that came out in this book.
And do you teach writing?
I do. I teach at California College of the Arts.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have a lot of writers who listen to this show, and you've just talked a little bit about your own experience as a writer. Mm-hmm. And how do you incorporate your writing in with your family, with your job?
It's hard. I would call writing maybe third on the list of things that I get to prioritize. So yeah, I have my kids. I teach part-time at CCA. I tend to generally dedicate 1 or 2 days a week to writing when I can. And that might just mean, you know, 3 hours in an afternoon. I have 2 writing buddies. One's a novelist and one's a memoirist. And we meet at a cafe every couple weeks. And that helps because it's an appointment that I have to be at. And I'm with these two writers who are going to be writing, and we'd better do it.
So you meet to share your work, or you meet to actually sit there and write together?
Yeah, we gossip for a few minutes and then we get our coffee and we sit and write together silently. Yeah. And that's just, it's just a way to get to a place where I'm going to be writing.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And what kind of advice do you give to your students and to people who are trying to prioritize writing in their own life?
Well, a lot of my students are only students, so they don't have their kids and their jobs taking their time away. But I warn them, you know, you're going to get to a point maybe in a year or so where you're going to have very little time to be writing. And my advice to them is to stake out that time, to be very possessive of their writing time. Because I know from my experience, you know, the people in my life, they love me, but they want a lot of my time, you know, and so I had to be a little selfish around my writing time.
Well, this book, it's a pretty hefty book. How long did it take you to write? I mean, you have 2 fully blown stories, really, mm-hmm. that converge around the young boy, and full sets of characters, full narrative lines. So how long did that take you?
It took me to get a single draft done about 2.5 years. And that was with, you know, I had a 2 or 3 year old and I was working as well. So it took me that long to get one draft done. And then I worked continuously. I had a couple rounds of rejections from publishers and just kept working. So I'd say a total of maybe 4 to 5 years.
Writing, it's only part of the journey, isn't it?
Yeah. Writing it once is just the beginning of the journey. And then there's lots of thought and reconsideration and editing.
And then getting into the publication phase. And now mm-hmm. it's, you're doing the work of selling the book.
Yeah, which is busy and it's exactly where I want to be. So having written this book, you know, I really do enjoy talking about it. It's sort of the reward at the end of all the work.
Well, I think right now where we are in our social and cultural history in this country at this moment in the state of California, it seems like it's an important thing to talk about immigration, to talk about people of color, to be talking about people of different cultures who are living, working, and inflecting each other's lives. And do you see that as just an outgrowth of who you are or something you're committed to as a person?
I've always been committed to writing about and thinking about immigration. That's just a natural outcropping of who I am and where I've been. I also feel like it's very important right now for us to be reading literature, because literature provides a framework to understand our times and to understand the people that we're seeing and hearing about on the news. And it's not just George Orwell. You know, everyone now is talking about 1984. But I believe in the power of reading positive stories, stories about women, stories about immigrants, because the president right now, you know, he got to the presidency by telling America a story. He had a very potent story that he told America. And it's important for us now to be forming our own stories and to be understanding our country on our terms as well.
And to be, in fact, creating those terms. And I think that that's something. And so thank you for putting out a book that does that and challenges our own conceptions of people's lives and people's journeys and of motherhood. I mean, I think we haven't maybe talked enough about that, that these mm-hmm. women share love for the same boy and have to make some really difficult choices around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm proud of this book, and I think it's pretty entertaining. And, you know, at the very least, if someone picks this up, I hope that it will raise in them some questions about what's going on. I don't think the book holds answers, but it does ask a lot of questions that need to be asked. And I think it's a pretty fun book to read. There's some heavy stuff in there, but I hope that people enjoy it.
There are some tough spots, but well, the funny things that happen to us in our daily lives and relationships, you capture quite well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this good read, and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. That was my conversation with Shanti Sekaran, and the book is Lucky Boy. Her last name is spelled Sekaran. We'll take a little break with the music of Abigail Washburn from her album, City of Refuge. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
With the faces, I can speak on the topic of religion. clouds keep rolling over, torn diamond lace. Booze on his collar, they never ask if the secrets pull me under. Under white sheets where all I do is wonder. Circle started to run with the gods. You gotta run harder. Run, 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 run to the city of red, where everyone is made. Oh, the city of red, where everyone is made.
That was Abigail Washburn with City of Refuge from her album of the same name. I'm Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea from KRCB Public Media. Recently, I had the pleasure of talking with Shelby London Heath from her home in Hawaii. Her novel is The Twilight Tsunami, a hard-hitting psychological story of social service workers who find themselves in dangerous situations every day and whose jobs require them sometimes to take children away from their parents. Shelby has worked as a counselor, social worker, and teacher, and she's also worked on a banana plantation in Spain and on coffee farms in Hawaii. Here's our conversation. Shelby London Heath, your just published book is The Twilight Tsunami. And it's a book set in the world of social services and child welfare, and deals with it from both sides of the dealing with the clients, the families who are in need of attention, and the workers who sometimes have the difficult job of intervening in situations. So what brought you to writing this particular book?
Well, I started out, as you know, working in the social field, going in and preventing child abuse, which then led me into dealing with child protective services, and I started to get to know some of the workers. And then through my job, protecting children, I actually took in a child whose mother could not take care of him, and she asked the state if I could take him. And so I moved through the whole system on various levels. And later when I became a counselor and was counseling foster children and families that came in, I realized I had a kaleidoscope vision of this field. And I felt responsible to tell the story, even though it's done in fiction form and there's a lot of drama in my book. But that's what started me.
You start the book and really end the book with a couple of characters, Gray and Christine, Gray in particular, who are a little bit raw. And I think that this is something that maybe many people have a very one-dimensional view of social workers and people involved in social services. But it takes a tremendous emotional toll on people doing that work.
It absolutely does, and not just emotional. You know, they're out in the battlefield seeing traumatic things, but also many social workers get ill, get psychosomatic symptoms and surgeries.
And this is as a result of having to essentially contain their own emotions as they are really sometimes going in and breaking apart dysfunctional families, taking children out of away from their parents. And that can be very gut-wrenching, yes?
It is. It's gut-wrenching. And under the term professional, they are trained to hold in their emotions, to not identify with any of the clients or have any transference problems. At the same time, a lot of these people are parents themselves. And you can imagine what that must do to them unconsciously. And then there's the factor of in-house stress and conflict. For instance, I once applied to Child Protective Services and I had to take a test. And then I had an interview. And at the interview, the supervisor said, "Do you think you could go into the hospital and remove a newborn and come back into the office and deal with social workers who would not be in agreement with what you went out and did?" And that really opened my eyes to what these workers go through. So it's not only out in the field, it's at work too. These people are under tremendous stress.
And you, in fact, portray both of those scenarios in the book, where a newborn child is immediately taken away from the mother because the baby tested positive for drugs. And you also depict the kind of inter-office dynamics that create a lot of pressure and stress as well. But let's talk about that situation with that you depict in the book, and that certainly happens with, we've all heard of crack babies and that sort of thing, that a mother loses her newborn right away.
That does happen, and I've got to tell you, I didn't choose to take that child protective job. And I've also never gone in and removed a baby, although I've come in after the baby's been removed to work with the family. But it could be that they just go in and take the baby. I dramatized it, you know, where the mother was aware of the baby being removed. To be honest, I'm not certain, but as a writer, I took that permission slip to go and make it dramatic. But nevertheless, when I've gone into families, the parents are distraught. If there's brothers and sisters, they're distraught, although most of the time, but not always, the brothers and sisters are also removed. So it's a terrible thing, and these workers have to do it. But it is, it happens quite a bit too lately with people on meth and ice and all of that. So it's getting to be, it's overwhelming social services.
And when we look at this from a social perspective, and here we have a rise of drug use in areas of the country where economically jobs have gone, or there's a shifting kind of dynamic. And yet with our, let's just say our current kind of government thrust right now in the administration and the things that are happening on a daily basis, we're seeing cuts to programs that are Planned Parenthood that might prevent some of these pregnancies, and to drug abuse programs and to social services themselves. And you mentioned that in the book, too, about budget cuts. So do you have any perspective on how we can navigate through any of this?
It is scary, because already the cuts were affecting the shortage of social workers, and it's really extreme because a lot of families are have members that are drug addicted and families that are suffering and children that need help. If we could bring in preventive programs, we could do a lot more for our society, because as we bring in more children that are either unwanted or the families cannot take care of them, we're bringing in potential criminals into our system as these children grow and don't get the help they need, and the parents don't get the help they need. These are the children that later climb in windows and do burglaries, and these are the children that later become homeless. In the end, the lack of services stress the society that we live in much more than if we could put programs in place now.
And in your book, you detail some of this, in fact, in a fictional sense, but it really does mirror what's going on. And that one of the successful programs that you outline in the book was funded through private sources. And do we see a lot of that, of private funds coming in to help with education and rehabilitation of people on the edge?
We do, but not enough. Not enough. And I know from working in nonprofit agencies, there's a real scramble for the small amount of foundational grants that come in from private sources. It's not enough. We really, really depend on the states to help and the federal government. And that money is shrinking every year. And we're getting more and more social problems. So there's very little private funding for social problems.
And in the book, you do highlight that there are some children who move from foster home to foster home and maybe have acting out behaviors because they've been wrenched from their environment and really are probably living in a state of fear. And then they essentially age out of the system with never having really had a stable environment. And that mirrors just what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And I don't want to discount the excellent foster parents that I've met that hang in for the long haul. But a lot of these foster parents are under tremendous stress, and there's so little money to really give these kids what they need. As you might know, it costs a lot to raise children, but it's a problem.
And in the book, you also do talk about foster parents, and why would somebody become a foster parent?
Well, you know, if you go to a health fair or a fair at a school, a lot of times you'll see a booth where there's social workers that come out and talk about the positive aspect of helping children, changing children's lives, giving love where maybe there isn't any. And then also many people go to church and really their hearts get filled and they want to help. They want to make the world better, and the first place to help would be to bring in children that need homes. And so a lot of the reason that I've seen is that people truly do want to make a difference. But people don't realize when they take in children, especially children that have already been moved around and have bonding problems, trust problems, how difficult it is without the support that a person needs when they take in children who are troubled. It's a lot of work. Many times the social workers are so overwhelmed already, and when they place a child, their attention, the social worker's attention, goes then to other children that need to be placed and other crises in their department. So the foster parent often is left with the foster children trying to deal with the situation. I'm not saying social workers disappear, but there is a lot of focus then on getting new clients placed and getting out and getting children out of trouble.
And some of your characters in the book who are social workers experience the frustration of wanting to do more home visits and wanting to provide more support, but they are taxed with having to do these interventions. And of course, it is a bureaucracy and they have to do paperwork.
A lot of paperwork and their legal pressures to get court reports done and then attend court and often stand on the witness stand. They have a lot of work that people don't even realize they have. They're paralegals almost, as well as being, workers that go out and help families.
Most people, I suspect, go into the field of social work because they have a great degree of compassion and a desire to want to make things better for people. Yet they get engaged with a system where they, in some cases, have to be bureaucrats and have to mask or harden that sense of compassion or contain it somehow. And I imagine that there are some people who just don't make it as social workers.
Oh, yeah. It's called burnout, and there's a high turnover of social workers, and they need their own debriefing at times that they don't always get. They have case upon cases piled on them. They have high expectations put on them to go out and do investigations in often dangerous places that cops would go in with a partner or take two cars out to investigate. But in these cases, these social workers go out by themselves into drug homes, into drug communities, and do the investigations on their own. It can be dangerous. It can be daunting. I can't minimize how much stress these workers are under. And yes, the bureaucracy is there too. They have a lot of administrative pressures. There's the pressures of liability. If anything goes wrong, if any child gets killed in a home that they're placed in, that is huge for the workers and the social services department. So they're always walking a fine line.
And all of this is the subject material of your novel, The Twilight Tsunami. And tell us a little bit about that title.
Well, I thought of this title long before the book Twilight came out. And in fact, I wanted to change it because I felt it was the Twilight was too popular, but the publisher said, no, stay with your title. But I was sitting in a room alone one evening when I was thinking of the book, and I was looking out at the sun going down over the ocean and thinking of my one child in the book who had the police and the social workers show up around twilight, around dinner time, and trying to think how that child felt, because a lot of these children actually feel kidnapped when complete strangers come up to their door. And I told myself it must be like a tsunami, a feeling of overpowering dread. And that's how I came up with the title.
Yeah. And yes, you do depict that in the book, where the child is just taken, or in some cases, children are just taken, leaving the parents and the children just completely frightened and bewildered, and then deposited someplace else, or if it's the parents, sometimes deposited in jail or a psych ward. So, and I wanted to also ask you about the cover art. You have some really striking cover art.
The art was done by a friend of mine. I hired her to do the artwork. I went over and described my main character to her, and she really went through an emotional experience creating that art piece, but I felt like she captured his true emotions as he wrestled with remaining a social worker or possibly saving himself by doing something else.
Well, the cover art is beautiful. And yes, the characters go through a real trajectory, or your main male character, Gray, goes through a real conversion of sorts from the opening scenes of the book to the closing scenes of the book. And we don't want to give too much of that away.
No, we can't give it away, can we? But
yes.
he's a complex character. I was relieved to find that he could be funny. I thought so anyway, and that he could be fun and unpredictable and yet still have that sense of responsibility and that depth and that emotion that I believe tugs at the reader. He's a lot of everything, and probably a lot of everything that's in all of us. So I really went with him and had a good time.
And what was the process of writing the book like for you? This is your first published novel?
You know, to be honest, it's one of the hardest things I've ever done. And I kept wanting to put it away. Put it away at times in the drawer, away from me. And then I'd pick it up. I'd start thinking, well, honestly, I'd think about the children. I'd see their faces, the children that have been in foster care, the children that I've counseled, and I just could not let it go. It took me quite a while. In fact, one summer when I was working on it really hard, I literally got emotional, and then I started to get so I couldn't walk. I know this sounds very dramatic, but literally I just spent the summer in agony. And then I had to break through with the book and then get to the other side of it before I could finish it. And this book was agonizing for me. There's a lot in the book that touches deep places, and especially when it comes to the children and the social workers. I've seen social workers go through terrible things. And always the triumph of the human spirit as they, all of them, try to rise up, not only to survive, but to be the best and do the best they can do. And I've seen amazing things with the children, too.
Well, that says it. The Twilight Tsunami, Shelby London Heath is the author. Shelby, is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, I'd like everyone to get out and read the book and see for themselves what's going on, and remember it's not all grief and doom and gloom, but it's also fun, and there's also some really wild and exciting parts to it. I think it would make a great movie. I really do. But that's my dream someday, so everyone could see it. And I do want to say that anywhere where there's children that need help or need a little extra support or even an afternoon, out to eat or taken to the ball game, please reach out and help the children, because there's a lot of children that are hurting.
And I guess for some people, they might be attracted to becoming foster parents, but it sounds like from what you've just said, there's many ways that we can participate in uplifting the lives of others, especially children in need.
Right. And this book is not to discourage foster parenting. I want to say that, because I've raised a child in the system, and it was tough. But when you get to the other side of it, it's one of the most wonderful things you could ever feel, that you helped a life along, and that and how much they appreciate it, and they've become a productive citizen. That's a great thing. But I also want to emphasize that we treat foster parents, social workers, and children better than we do in this system. That's a real point that I try to drive home.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and for creating a book that exposes something that maybe most of our readers are not familiar with, and in a way that really does unpack it for us and entertain at the same time.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of people have said they couldn't put the book down. It was a good read. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
That was my conversation with Shelby London Heath, and her book is The Twilight Tsunami, with striking cover art by Andre Diana. I spoke with Shelby from her home in Hawaii. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Shanti Sekaran with her book, Lucky Boy. Both of these novels are gripping, sometimes humorous, and expose the vulnerability and powerlessness of many families in our country today. Thank you very much for listening. You can hear me regularly on this station and all the time online. Subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. We have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. We'll go out with something special from Doug Jane. Thanks, Doug. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.
I was walking by the river, he was lying by the water on the ground. He was a tragic figure, probably died without a liver or a town. He said, I'm not dead. I'm not dead yet. Faces out there seem to know me. Places look familiar to me. Not sure why. Movies last a little longer. People moving so much faster every year. But I'm not dead yet. I'm not dead yet. Liberty's a dying quail. Equality moves like a snail up a wall. Freedom's not for everybody. Justice is supposed to be for one and all. But it's not. It's not dead yet. Love your baby, love your mother. Treat everybody like your brother. Floss each day. Keep the wheels between the lines and hold two fingers in the sky and wish for peace. 'Cause it's not dead yet. It's not dead.